Hey guys, today is our interview finale for season one. I can hardly believe that we are at this point. After I record this, I feel like I'm going to start crying, but also drinking champagne at the same time. Anyway, I digress. I have a very special guest for our show today, Jason Calacanis. As some of you may know, Jason is an entrepreneur who sold his company Weblogs for many, many millions of dollars in the earliest years of this century. And since that time, he's become, by any measure, a successful angel investor and the host of two podcasts, This Week in Startups and the aptly named Angel. Despite this cheery intro, there have been many ups and downs during the course of Jason's life, both professional and personal. Along the way, he's developed a reputation for picking fights with people, being combative, a term he actually used to describe himself in his book about angel investing. So while I wanted to talk to Jason about his podcast, and I did, and you'll hear that, I also wanted to find out who is Jason Calacanis? What makes this guy tick? Because the final thing you need to know about Jason is that in addition to being all of the things I've already mentioned, he is also my boss. Before we get going, I want to share a few words from the folks behind another podcast about podcasts that I think you might like. It's called Radio Drama Revival, and it's a lot of fun. Listen in.
With so much greatness happening in audio fiction, it can be hard to find the best of the best. So why not have someone do the work for you? On Radio Drama Revival, our team of experts showcase the diversity and vitality of modern audio fiction. And then we ask the creators the questions you'd want to ask.
Their relationship is important to you.
I'm shipper trash, David, you can say it. It's okay.
And my question to you is, can it be Keisha time? Like, what do you dream about achieving not only for your neighborhood, but for yourself?
All day.
Maybe before you realize you'd want to ask them.
Do you think souls exist?
I personally do.
When I ask you to visualize time, what do you see?
Yeah. Okay.
I guess I've got quite a dark sense of humor in some ways.
Do you feel that you think about death more often or differently than you would otherwise now that you've been playing these characters?
Find great new audio fiction by finding us at radiodramarevival.com.
All right, guys, I'm back and we're ready to roll the tape on my interview with Jason Calacanis. The only other thing you need to know is that at the end of this episode, I will announce some very exciting news about season two. Okay, here we go. All right, let's get right into it.
Thanks for having me on your podcast.
Oh, yes. Thank you for coming.
I love your studio.
Thanks for coming down the stairs. I've listened to you on your podcast, obviously, and also guesting on others.
Yep.
And one thing that you've said that stood out to me is that you had no power as a child.
Yeah.
And I'd like to hear more about why.
Yeah, wow, you're going right there. Look
I'm
at this.
I'm going right there.
Right here, Diane Sawyer. So... I grew up in Brooklyn, as some people know, and it was in the 70s and 80s, and that was the time at which you wanted to get out of Brooklyn. Like, our entire goal was to not be from Brooklyn, to just get out. Mm-hmm. And getting out typically meant getting across the bridge into Manhattan. Because we were second-class citizens coming from Brooklyn, New Yorkers looked down on us. Brooklyn was not cool. Brooklyn was the opposite of cool. And I grew up in a time when New York and Brooklyn was particularly violent. And I grew up in a particularly violent situation in retrospect, which is I grew up in my dad's bar. And my dad's bar was like growing up in a Scorsese movie. Hmm. And I mean that in a literal fashion. Mm-hmm. Guns, Hell's Angels, cops, crooked cops, drug dealers, bookies. And this is at the age of 7 years old, 8 years old. So my daughter's nine now. So 2 years earlier than she is now. I was working at my dad's bar in kindergarten or first grade. My dad would pick us up from school, 2 o'clock, public school in Brooklyn, take us to the restaurant, and we would set up the dining room. We, you know, had like a 10-seat dining room in the back of the bar where people order chops and stuff like that. And then when I was maybe 8 or 9, I would go with my grandfather, God rest his soul, to the 6:05 mass, and I would be an usher, and there would be 6 old ladies there, and he was an usher, and I would bring the sacraments up. We get through the 40-minute mass. We'd walk over to my dad's bar, and my grandfather, who was a firefighter, would then be the porter. We wouldn't call him a janitor or anything like that because that would be demeaning, but he was we call the porter is what he liked to call himself. Mm-hmm. So we'd show up at 6:50, 7 a.m., And my dad would still be there. The bars closed at 4 a.m., but my dad would run a poker game or they would be playing backgammon. Mm. And they would be there. They'd have a couple drinks in them. And one of my earliest memories, you know, I think people remember three or four memories from like under the age of nine, I was told recently. And I was thinking about that and I was like, wow, that's torturous because I'm trying to think of my earliest memories. They're all violent, right? Like they're all burned into my brain. So you start thinking about how crazy violent this was. So I came one time, my dad threw some guy, his face exploded, it's covered in blood. The guy's crawling under a car, wow, trying to get away from my dad. Well, the guy had tried to rob the bar. He had reached over and took a bottle of vodka out of the speed rack. Mm. Not a great thing to do with my dad, who was a bull. Anyway, he beats the guy up and I'm like, oh my God, you know, your heart's racing. And you're, you know, when your dad's like a tough guy like that, this is like an intense situation. And my dad just looks at me like a bull and he goes, don't look at it, clean it up. I'm like, you got to pop. I run inside. I get hot water. I'm cleaning up the blood. The cops show up and I'm like, oh my God, my dad's going to jail. And the cops start laughing. My dad invites them in. They have a couple of drinks in uniform.
Wow.
So this is like to give people an idea of how I grew up. And then I just wanted to, you know, my entire goal in life was to have power, to not get beat up, and to have money. Because everything in my childhood was about not having money and not having power. And now at 48, I understand all this. But there was a period in there in my 18 to 30-year-old self as an entrepreneur that I was like, why am I so driven? Why do I work so hard? Why am I a 7-day-a-week, 12-hour, you know, guy?
Yeah.
And that was the reason. I just did not want to be broke.
I think you have two brothers.
Two brothers, yeah. My younger brother, Josh, is a firefighter.
Okay.
My older brother, Jamie, worked at Dow Jones and now works at another startup.
Did they have the same – did they come away from that experience with sort of the same level of like, I've got to get out of here. I've got to win.
No. I was the middle child. My younger brother definitely has a similar work ethic to me, mm-hmm, but a great sense of purpose. And the two of us took the police, New York City Police Department test, and we were going to go in. Mm-hmm. And at the last minute, I said, you know, I got into Fordham. And that was my dream school. So I'm going to go to Fordham at night and I got to figure out a way to pay for it myself. My parents had no money. So I had to work two or three jobs to just pay for the $9,000 a year and go at night. Mm-hmm. And I told him, like, let me get my degree and then I'll come be a detective in the police department. I'll circle back, mm-hmm, around. And then he wanted to be a firefighter, but that was a very hard job to get. And so my grandfather's a firefighter. My uncle's a cop. My cousin's a cop. My other cousin is in the State Department. Other cousins in the FBI. Yeah.
So, and getting back to this idea of being powerless.
Yeah.
So I can see how that might have been, well, to me, it would have been terrifying to see what your father did to someone else.
Yeah.
I don't know if that was terrifying to you.
It got normalized pretty quick.
Okay. Was that kind of thing?
Which is a problem.
Yeah. Was that kind of thing happening at home?
A little bit, yeah. I mean, we were warriors, I think, and there was a lot of fighting. But all the fighting that my parents had was over money. So when you think about, mm-hmm, it, like, this was the other thing that really drove my personality. And it took therapy and self-awareness and running marathons and meditating and a lot of other things to sort of be aware of this dynamic. But my parents only fought over money. Other than that, it was a very loving relationship. My dad beat people up who needed to be taught a lesson for stealing or behaving badly in a bar.
Mm-hmm. Like, not you.
No. I mean, I'd been hit as a child, but not like on a regular basis, but, mm-hmm, still enough that it was scary and terrifying.
Okay.
So maybe a half dozen times or something like that. This is when spanking was still allowed and that kind of stuff. So that is one of my earlier memories, was getting spanked by my dad at the age of 5 or 6. So when you think about this stuff in that era, and, you know, I've since reconciled with my father about all this stuff, but it is, I think, when you're a child and you grow up in that kind of world, and then you go to school in an all-boys Catholic school where it's Lord of the Flies, literally. Mm. Like, and many of the situations I was in with my brothers and just living in Brooklyn was a battle. Like, and all the fights, interestingly, at that time in the 80s were race fights. Irish versus Italian, Puerto Rican versus Black, Black versus Italian. I mean, it was a war zone in Brooklyn.
At school or
school and
outside?
On the street.
Yeah,
and I grew up in a generation where, you know, forget about helicopter parents. We were free range. So from a very early age, my dad would get home from the bar and say, my mom would be at work on a 12-hour shift as a nurse. My dad would get home and say, okay, everybody out of the house. I need to sleep. You know, he's getting home from the poker game or the backgammon game at 7 a.m., 8 a.m. He comes home to a bunch of boys, whether it's the summer, if it was the summer or the weekend, get out of the house. Here's $20. Come back at 5 o'clock. So we were out on the streets of Brooklyn with a $20 bill or $40, three boys in 1980, 8, 9, 10, 9, 10, 11, 10, 11, 12, for 12 hours, you know, on our own, 10 hours. You can imagine the trouble a bunch of boys get into in that kind. I mean, we were doing very bad things.
Like what?
Shoplifting, fighting, vandalism.
How would people describe you at that age?
We're punks. We're punk kids, you know. Uh-huh. I mean, but we were the average kid in Brooklyn at that era.
Right.
And it was a different era. Like people, you know, you basically went to school and you had to go with a group of people. You came home with a group of people because if you didn't roll with a group of people, you could get jumped.
Yeah.
And I look back on it and I'm just like, I don't think that's how kids grow up today. And that's not how all kids grew up back then. But that's how you grew up in Brooklyn.
Did you have any adult figure who believed in you as a child?
Yeah, when I was 15, I was getting thrown out of high school for having bad grades. And my professor, my science professor, Charles Fasano, now Dr. Fasano, was my science teacher. And he went to bat for me with the principal of the school, Brother Warren, said I was being kicked out. And Dr. Fasano said to Brother Warren, I think if he joined Taekwondo, he's got potential. And Brother Warren said, okay, if he joins the Taekwondo club at Severin High School, I will let him finish out the year and then we'll make a decision on kicking him out in June. And so I came home one day and my mom said, you're joining Taekwondo. And I said, what? And she goes, yeah, you're getting kicked out of school. And I was like, all right, fine, I'll go. And I went and I acted like a jerk and I started practicing and all the black belts and brown belts in the front row didn't look at me. And I was like, well, this is weird. Like they're just so focused, like lasers on what they're doing, their forms, the freestyle. And I was like, all right, well, I have to be here, so I might as well make the best of it. And then I got good at it. And then I went to West Point after like 4 or 5 months. I was in a tournament. I was a yellow belt. And I got to the finals. And it was like a real Karate Kid kind of moment. I was like, wait a second. I've been practicing this for 4 months. I'm a yellow belt. And I just beat 2 green belts, the next belt level up. And I just freestyled with a purple belt who was 200 pounds and I was 130 or 40 pounds wet out of the shower. And I put up a good fight. And I was like, wait a second, this is what I should be doing. I am more disciplined and I'm better at this. And so I became a black belt when I was 17. And then I ran my first New York City marathon at 17. And so that was sort of the turning point in my life where I just went from being a punk kid to being much more disciplined. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I kind of channeled the violence a little bit, I think. Like, oh, okay, I can still freestyle and be in tournaments and learn how to do all these incredible techniques, which are much more effective than the techniques my dad knows. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not just throwing people into a mailbox. I can jump over the mailbox, throw a flying sidekick, and break 4 boards. Like, there's pictures of me on the internet breaking, like, some of the most complex breaks in martial arts. When I was a kid and I could jump over 4 or 5 chairs.
We should post links to that in the show notes.
I think there's one on my Instagram. It's pretty funny. Looking back on it, obviously, you know, I wanted that power. Yeah. And I also realized I needed discipline. And so when I went to line up for the New York City Marathon, the way it used to work was you lined up in Central Park and you gave them 2 envelopes with stamps on it, 2 money orders. It was a whole like rigmarole before the internet. This is 1987. And I give the application to the woman at the lineup from the New York Roadrunners Club. This is when the guy Fred LeBeau was running it, and he was there, and he's like pushing people down the line. He was like quite a character. And I give her my envelopes, and she goes, oh, you were born in 1970. You're 17 at the time of the marathon. I said, yeah. She goes, you have to be 18. And I said, oh, I put it down wrong. She looks at me, and she goes, you put it down wrong. I said, yeah, did I put 1970? And she goes, yeah. I said, oh, no, I was born in 69. My brother was born in 70. And she looks at me.
She bought it?
And she hands it back to me. She goes, okay, then maybe you should change that to 1969. And I said, okay. And I change it to 1969. And I hand it back to her. She goes, enjoy the run. And so that's when I started to get this inclination that I had the ability to get away with anything. And that it was a very early lesson I learned that I was an incredibly convincing person.
You were persuasive.
I had persuasion. I had discipline. Mm-hmm. And I had drive. And that is like a wicked combination. Especially, I also had the ability I had gone from being a 67 student to a 94 average, 67 in my first year, 94 in my last year. And I had learned discipline through the martial arts and through the marathon running that I didn't know I had. And then I learned that I could convince myself or other people of anything. And I started meditating back then in 1987, 1988. I had read, when I got to college, actually in 88, I had read about positive visualization and meditation mm-hmm. and how people had done positive visualizations to imagine themselves doing things in the Olympics or doing things in meditation. And when I read about that, I was like, oh, positive visualization. How does it work?
Seems like a very enlightened thing for someone of your age and in that time.
So I would just lay down on the floor and I would think, okay, I'm going to go through every mile of the marathon and imagine it. And I was like, I imagine myself in the first mile. Imagine myself in the second mile. And I would just say to myself, my body's a machine controlled by my mind, and I have control of my mind, and I can do anything. And I would just repeat myself that every mile. And then when I was in the marathon, every mile, I'd say, my body's a machine. My mind controls that machine. And I can do this. Boom, every mile. I just positively visualize it. And then, you know, I used to say to myself, like, I can figure out how this power structure works in Manhattan. And it was very weird because I didn't exactly get it right, but I got it right enough because I remember the moment I was like on the B train going into Manhattan. I had bought magazines and I used to hang out in cafes. And magazines in the 90s, 80s into the 90s were the power structure.
They were it.
They were it. And I would look at magazine covers and I go, how did this person get on the cover of Esquire or New York magazine? Who's this Donald Trump guy? What's this spy magazine? And I would be looking at these magazines. And at some point, I'd just stare at the masthead, became fascinating to me. And the masthead had different sizes. Graydon Carter, editor-in-chief. This person, Norm Perlstein, publisher. Who's that? This person, that person. What's an associate editor? What's a managing editor? And why is the managing editor on top of the associate editor? Who's the editor at large? That sounds pretty cool, but they're below the editor, and the publisher's between the editor and the editor at large. I was just fascinated by the power structure of the masthead.
You're like deconstructing it. Yeah,
but nobody. I didn't have anybody to tell me. I'd never been to a magazine. I never met anybody who worked at a magazine. Mm-hmm. And so that's when I decided, well, you could either be the person who's on the cover of the magazine, or you could pick who's on the cover. And in my warped mind, I just thought, the person who picks who's on the cover is more important. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's actually true, but it is true in a certain way that, you know, a lot of power, you know, would sit on Jan Wenner's desk to pick who's on the cover of mm-hmm. Rolling Stone or Graydon Carter's for Vanity Fair or before that Spy magazine or Kurt Anderson with Spy magazine. And eventually I wound up meeting all those people and hanging out with them in New York and building magazines, which was to me a way of just getting power.
What was it like to hang out with those people?
It was interesting. At one point, Condé Nast wanted to buy an internet magazine, and I had one of the top five, Silicon Eye Reporter. And there was Wired, Upside, Red Herring, Mondo 2000, and my magazine covering the space. I was the smallest, but I was the New York gritty one who had the best covers. Mm-hmm. And Graydon Carter had come to me. We were at Bond Street Sushi, and he saw my badge, and he said, oh, Jason Calacanis, Silicon Eye Reporter. I advocated for Condé Nast to buy Silicon Eye Reporter. We wound up buying Wired. You know, it's bigger business, whatever. But I was so impressed. Your covers were better than Wired's, in my opinion.
Hmm.
And I was like, thanks, Graydon Carter. And he said,
that's a big deal coming
from
him.
Yeah, and he said, how did you, you know, do all this, whatever? And I said, oh, Jan Wenner taught me. And David Hershkovitz from Paper. And he's like, oh, okay. Yeah, I told them I said hi. So I had gotten a column in Paper magazine, and Kim Hershkovitz and David Hershkovitz and Kim, the co-founders, taught me how to do magazine covers there. And Jan Wenner from Rolling Stone had spent a couple hours with me teaching me about magazines.
What an opportunity. Yeah. So you were famously offered $20 million.
For that magazine,
which you turned down. And
I got 2 years severance out of it.
You did. 9/11 happened. The market tanked. And so you sold it, right, for about 2 years' salary.
2 years' salary,
yeah. And they fired you.
They fired me a week after they bought it. So, like, Dow Jones had wound up buying it. And they just didn't want me around. But they wanted my older brother, Jamie. And so they were like, hey, we're going to fire you. Here's 2 years' severance. And I was like, you're going to give me $300,000 or something like that right now in one lump sum? Mm-hmm. And that was a lot less than the, you know, I would have probably taken 17 or 18 million of the 20 million from the first sale. And I was like, I guess that's a good thing now that the Twin Towers are down and the mm-hmm. world is fucked. Sure, I'll take it. They were like, can you make sure your brother doesn't quit? And I was like, sure. He ran all the sales. Mm. And so they didn't want me around. But they did want my brother. And they didn't want my personality inside the building.
How did that feel?
It was perplexing, but I was self-aware at that point to realize I was an entrepreneur and that the only way they would ever keep me is by making me the CEO of Dow Jones or the president, or, you know, making this insane 29 or 30 year old kid in charge of everything, because that's just the way I look at the world. You know, I need to be in the captain's seat. I'm not really like a co-pilot, nor am I like, you know, a navigator or, you know, control tower, flight attendant, baggage claim. Like, I got to be
the
captain.
You want to be at the... I gotta be at the controls. King of the hill.
Well, yeah. It's not even king of the hill. Like, it's not like I want to like look down on everybody. I like being at the instrument panel. Mm-hmm. I like being at the controls.
Where the power is.
Where the power is. Yeah, I like to have that power on my fingertips, and I like to steer the plane. And so, if you're aware of that, you know, then you can channel it. Which is just, there's no reason for me to try to not be the pilot if I enjoy being the pilot at this point.
Yeah.
Right? If you enjoy being a Jedi Knight, you want to do Jedi missions. Mm-hmm. You don't want to, you know, work in a cantina.
But after this happened, so you had a series of things that happened that were not good.
Yeah.
9/11,
the market crash.
You lose your, yeah, all that stuff. Yeah. You've said that you were depressed during that time.
Yeah.
I'm curious to know what a depressed Jason Calacanis like.
I had PTSD in hindsight.
Right.
From 9/11 that I didn't know I had. It was undiagnosed. And maybe 5 years after, my wife was like, you know, I think this 9/11 thing is like, you cry when an ambulance happens. You can't watch the TV when they talk about the 9/11 anniversary. And I just went to PTSD therapy.
Did she push you to do that?
Yeah, she did. She did. And we're very thankful for that, because after four or five sessions, the amount of stress I felt even talking about 9/11 went from like 100 or 98% of the experience of watching the towers come down, all the way down to, okay, that was a horrible thing. The world has gotten better since then, I hope. And we got through it, and bad things happen in the world, and bad things can happen to good people. But that the sense of injustice of 9/11 really just hit me very hard.
Mm-hmm. I would love to hear literally what you were doing with your days during that time when you were going through this depression time. Like, were you like a I'm going to spend all day in bed kind of person?
No, no. And when I say I was depressed, I would probably say most people would interpret it as cantankerous and melancholy, cynical.
Just your mood was altered.
Yeah, my mood was definitely altered, and I think I became a little bit cantankerous, maybe on the edges, and just was frustrated at myself for not taking the money when I had the chance.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Was frustrated that the internet had exploded by a bunch of charlatans who I knew were pumping the stock market and were not really in it and weren't the early true believers. So I was kind of frustrated about those people screwing up the internet business because it was going so wonderfully before the charlatan showed up. But I knew it was real, and then it just put a fire in my belly, because all my friends were going to Thailand and taking a year off and just like, well, the whole thing's a scam. Screw it. Gen Xers were just like, all right, I guess the whole thing is just a giant scam. It's a big nothing. We're all going to just check out. And I was like, nope, I'm going to build another company.
Yeah.
What else could be big? And to
then,
me,
and then you did.
I did weblogs, and I was like, blogs are going to be huge. It's so obvious to me. I'm going to build a company worth $20 million and sell it as quick as possible.
What did it feel like when, so you build weblogs, you sold it for 30 for $30 million.
18 months after we started it.
What did it feel like to come back from that failure and have such a successful outcome?
It was confirming. It was confirming that even though I was a Jedi Knight and had lost my hand in the last lightsaber battle, that I could come back and win the next lightsaber battle. It literally felt exactly like that to me. I was like, I am a Jedi. I can build companies. I can sell them. I can create value. I know exactly what's coming around the corner because I read and I study the technology. So I can brush this off. I got hit in the head with the ball, or, you know, got defeated like, you know, Luke Skywalker or whatever. And I will just get a mechanical hand, train some more, and I'll go back and defeat the Emperor. And that's exactly the metaphor in my mind was, you know, I use those metaphors like to just help in storytelling for me to contextualize how I got to this point and then what the potential is for the future, right? I look at myself and, you know, I was probably the Luke Skywalker phase back then, and I'm in the Obi-Wan phase now, and maybe another 20 years would be the Yoda phase. But right now I feel like, you know, in startups, in media, I have like an Obi-Wan type amount of experience, not Yoda, not Luke. I'm not naive.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not, you know, the Grandmaster, but I'm definitely a Jedi Master at this point of how this works and how to deploy power intelligently, compassionately, effectively.
Going back to that moment when you had a successful outcome with weblogs, what did you do after that sale? Did you celebrate? Did you take some time off? Cried happy tears?
This is going to sound incredibly vapid, and people will clip this and use it when I run for mayor. But literally, I was sitting there, and I was refreshing my Bank of America account and waiting and waiting. And I think the first payment AOL had to make was $20 million of the $30 million. We had like an earnout, or maybe it was 15 of 25, and then they paid another $5 million. Anyway, I was trying to figure out the exact numbers. But anyway, I was sitting there hitting refresh with Brian Alvey on the line. And he's like, did the wire come in?
He was your co-founder.
My co-founder. Yeah. I'm just hitting refresh, refresh, refresh. And then, the bank account goes from 4,000 to 15 million, 4,000, you know. And I just cried. And my wife said, why are you crying? And I said, oh, I don't have to worry about money now. Mm-hmm. And that was like the big arc right from the beginning. Like, oh, my God, we're going to run out of money. Oh, my God, this is going to be a problem. And that gives me
from your youth.
From my youth.
Yes.
It was like super cathartic. So getting the black belt and running the marathons meant I didn't have to physically be scared. Like, yeah. I'm not physically scared in any situation. I'm cautious. Mm-hmm. I'm aware of how fragile human bodies are. Like, but in any kind of an emergency situation, having worked on an ambulance, being a black belt in Taekwondo, being trained in firearms, like, I'm not a physically scared person in an intense situation. I realize the gravity of it, having been in situations like car accidents or doing CPR on somebody who's died and is not coming back.
Like, you were an EMT, right?
I was an EMT first responder, like the lowest level, and I worked on a volunteer bus in Brooklyn called Bravo, Bay Ridge Ambulance Volunteer Organization. Hmm. And it was like one of the best years of my life doing that. And I think it was a series of not being worried physically, not being worried about dying, not being worried about not having money. And as you check those Maslow hierarchy needs off and you reconcile your childhood, you know, you can sort of be free and play for the love of the game. Like, I love being a Jedi. I love what I do. And a lot of what I do now is I sit with founders and I talk to them about their fear. And I sit to them and talk to them about their dream. And then I work with them to take their dream and their fear and their startup, which is the manifestation of their entire life, and see if it can become successful, knowing that 70% of the time it goes to zero.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like Jedi Knights going on a mission, knowing, one out of three chance we come back
mm-hmm.
with our limbs.
Mm-hmm.
Two out of three chance we're coming back with less limbs or less people than we went. And I can go into that. It doesn't even change my pulse. Like, every day I get a phone call mm-hmm. from a founder. You're going to lose $300,000 on this investment. You lose $1 million on this investment. The company's shutting down. And I'm like, yeah, that's okay.
You're in a place where you can feel that way.
I can, right, because I know that, you know, that is how the game works. Mm-hmm. That is the architecture of startups. And it's sort of freeing having been through it. And it's very rewarding for me to sit with people who want to change the world as entrepreneurs. This is why I feel passionately about entrepreneurs and entrepreneurialism and capitalism mm-hmm. and why I fight the socialists on the Twitter.
Oh, good. I'm so glad you brought that up. So, and after that, you famously, I think, made an investment in Uber
yep.
as a Sequoia Scout. I want to get to your podcast.
Yeah.
When you made that investment, were you already podcasting yet?
Yeah.
How did that sort of walk me through the origin story of the podcast and sort
sure.
of how that might have come out of you becoming this scout and then angel yeah. investor?
So in the 90s, I was on a network called Pseudo, PSEUDO.com, mm-hmm. that my friend Josh Harris, when I was a journalist, he bought an hour of airtime at WEVD Radio in New York, and then he combined it with a Prodigy chat room. And he would talk to people in the chat room and say, if you're in New York City, turn your radio to 1050 WEVD, and I'm going to read the names of the people in the chat room over the radio to you. It was at 1 a.m. And I would come on, and I would do Cyber Surfer, which was my handle online, top 10 websites on the internet. And I was so bad at it, and I couldn't speak well. And that's how I got my start in radio in 1995. And then he.
But you couldn't speak well?
Not really.
So what did you.
I was just nervous, and he didn't care because he was paying $1,000 for the radio, and he was getting paid $3 an hour for everybody in the chat room. And he had hundreds of people in the chat room. So he was making thousands of dollars every hour he kept him in the chat room. So it was a real business model back then. It was $5 an hour, $6 an hour to be online. People would be online for 3 or 4 hours a night. He would get half the money that Prodigy got or CompuServe would get. Anyway, he started a streaming network where we did live streaming shows called the Pseudo Network, and I would do the Cyber Surfer show, and then it became called the Silicon Eye Reporter show. So I had my bad, you know, sort of interpretation of Howard Stern kind of interview talk show
Emulating Howard Stern?
Yeah, for sure, 100% emulating Howard. And I'd be like, oh, it's crazy, my life is crazy, everybody. You know, it wasn't like strippers and nonsense, but I was just like...
That was my next question.
No, I was just like very bombastic and New Yorker kind of thing in that way. And then when podcasting happened, we were doing RSS feeds for all our blogs at Weblogs Inc. And Dave Weiner had created the RSS standard, which is how blogs work. And then he added attachments to blogs. And then people could put an attachment to a blog, like a picture or an MP3. And MP3s have come out. And then Dave Weiner said, okay, well, I can talk and give you a written blog post. I'll speak it. And then I made a piece of software called the Podcatcher that you put in your system tray on your Mac. It downloads from, you put the RSS feed in, it downloads the files, and then you plug in your iPod, and it will sync all of the files onto your iPod and pretend it's a record. And then you look up the album name, Dave Weiner's, you know, Daily Notes or whatever, and you'll see it there. And then a guy named Adam Curry, who was the video DJ.
Oh, yes, I remember.
He started doing one, and he became very popular. And then at the DConf, at this Wall Street Journal D conference, which I went to as a journalist, Kara Swisher made a big announcement. Steve Jobs had a big announcement. Steve Jobs decided in iTunes to have a dropdown that said add podcast. And so he killed all the podcast players. And you could add a URL to your iTunes that then managed this process of filling your iPod. Because remember, nobody had data connections on their iPods. There was no data connection.
Right.
So podcasting started back then. And I started something called Calacanis Cast. I did 30 episodes of that over a year or two. And then I decided to call it This Week in Startups because I was on Leo Laporte show This Week in Tech.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, well, I'm doing startups and I'm going to be an angel investor. So I'll start this. Sequoia started talking to me about angel investing. And so I just started the podcast This Week in Startups because when I would be on Leo's show, startups would be 10% of the content. But then people were like, and I would be on 1 out of 10 shows. And I asked Leo, is it okay if I use This Week in Startups? He's like, yeah, sure, go for it.
Was this your, are you like doing this in your house and you're living? Like,
I was doing it at Mahalo's conference room.
Okay, and by yourself?
I had my friend Tyler Crowley, who was on the early episodes with me. He was, as one person called him, my body man. He was my chief of staff. Wherever I went, I brought him with me. So when I would travel the world, speaking gigs, business deals, he would just go with me and keep me company. He was somebody who read my blog and was a day trader. And I said, I want to start this podcast thing, Calacanis Cast. Would you come in and record it for me? Because you comment on my blog and you were in a band and you know how to use a recorder. And so he would come in, he would get a recorder, like a Zoom recorder or whatever it was back then. And put a microphone on the table. We do it on an open air microphone. And yeah, we just started. And then I said, well, let's just get a camera and put a camera on. And This Week in Startups was 10 years ago, as of 2 months ago. We've done 950 episodes.
Mm-hmm.
We have our own studio now. We have 6 full-time people working on it. And
I'm
here we are.
Comfortable here in your studio.
Yeah.
What was it like, though, to start a podcast then in terms of developing audience and growing it and did you just put it out there and sort of go like, well, I hope someone picks it up?
Well, I was a popular blogger already. And so I was known for writing blog posts that would trend on something called Technorati, which was a blog search engine at the time. And so Technorati would have the top 20 or 30 blog posts of the day. We did the first ad on a blog ever, Autoblog, which was our car blog. We had a salesperson named Sean Gold who sold Volvo on doing a podcast for $40,000 for 10 episodes. And Volvo was like, tell me again what a podcast is. And we explained it to him. And they had already had success advertising the blog. And like, yeah, we have an experimental budget, do it. And there's all these questions like, what if we talk about Volvo during the podcast? And, you know, it was hilarious. But anyway, we sold the first podcasting sponsorship in history at Weblogs Inc. And then I started mine. So I knew about it. I knew about independent publishing and I knew about brand building. And so I just said to myself, I have lunch with people every week. I'm just going to record. I probably have 3 or 4 lunches or dinners a week. I'm going to record the most interesting one. And so I'll have Evan Williams on when he was doing Blogger and, you know, whoever on my friend Travis from Uber and, you know, this person or that person. This kid Kevin from Bourbon or what's he calling it now? Instagram? It was Bourbon. But now it's Instagram. Okay, sure. Whatever. I'll have you on the podcast. And, you know, it wasn't perfect, but I took the Howard Stern approach, which was it's going to be an hour or two, and it's not going to be filtered. It's going to be unfiltered, and we're just going to have an honest talk. And, you know,
I did hear that at one point there was also talk of doing a TV show with Harvey Weinstein.
Yeah, that actually got very far. A woman named Carmela Casolini contacted me, and she was working as a consultant to Harvey, who did Project Runway. And I knew Harvey from Sundance. I'd never met him before. And they wanted to build a show around what I do as an investor. And they were looking for somebody. And they said they wanted to do like The Voice, I guess, kind of format. And I said, that's fine, but you should just fire the other two people and just do me. And they were like, they laughed. And I said, well, actually, I have a reason for it. I said, you know, you're going to have two groups of people here. Make an XY axis. Successful, incredible. Right? Mm-hmm. The successful credibility, you know, access, and then willingness to talk on TV.
Yeah.
Willingness to do a TV show. And you'll have Mark Cuban, who's much more successful than me and as willing to talk as me. And then you'll have everybody else in Silicon Valley who is scared to death to talk or be honest because it's bad for business. Right? Like mm-hmm. me talking about my feelings about human rights is very bad for business for me because it means... me going to China after being critical of China is a risk factor for me, maybe. Me going to Saudi Arabia, I would never be able to go because I've been too critical of the human rights issues there. And I would never be able to have those people as LPs, limited partners in my funds, because I've been so critical of them in all likelihood. Mm-hmm. Although maybe sometimes you neg somebody and you take a stand against them that makes them 10 times more likely to come to you. Mm-hmm. But so there's that possibility. And so I just told them, listen, I've been through this. I have guests on my podcast. They don't want to talk about anything or make it exciting. So you need somebody in reality TV, whether it's Trump, whether it's Cuban, whether it's Gordon Ramsay, whether it's Tyra Banks or any of these people who are fearless in what they're going to say, but also credible. Mm-hmm. Like she's a supermodel and she will say what she wants. She doesn't care. Mm-hmm. Same with Cuban, et cetera. And so we did a sizzle reel. NBC bought the show. NBC did the pilot. I have them on my phone. Can't really? Show them to anybody. And
will you ever?
No, I can't.
You're not allowed.
No, I'm not allowed. Okay. And they spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on it. And then Harvey Weinstein turns out to be a horrible human being.
Okay, so it all got...
it blew up in the Harvey stuff. And then NBC and other people still want to do stuff with me. Uh-huh. And I put it on pause right now because I'm too busy. Uh-huh. So there's a possibility that I could do it again. But the reason I would want to do it is because I want people to participate in angel investing in the technology space because I feel passionate about entrepreneurship. It would probably require me to move to LA mm-hmm. to do it, which means it would screw up a lot of the stuff I'm doing here. So I'll see in 2020 if it's something I want to do. Okay. I have many offers. I've been offered to be a full-time like correspondent on like network news kind of mm-hmm, stuff. Mm-hmm. So I have those other opportunities and you probably see me do a CNBC once a month, mm-hmm. sometimes four times a month, depending. And they wanted me to be like a formal contributor. I haven't done that yet because I like to have the control over when I appear, not them. Mm-hmm. You know, I can go away for 2 months like I did right now with the Uber IPO. I'm like, not interested in being the Uber spokesperson.
No, no. Yeah.
Not a good look for me mm-hmm. as an angel investor. But I'll be back on CNBC maybe as soon as next week or the week after now that the Uber IPO has kind of settled down. Mm-hmm. So we'll see. It was really super interesting to be in business with Harvey. I'll tell you that. I mean, he's a crazy individual.
What do you remember? What can you share with us about that?
I remember walking into like the major networks and there would be, in one case, 20 people in the lobby waiting for our arrival.
Why?
From the CEO to the development executives to pay respect to him.
Mm, I see.
And he walks in and everybody bows down and, you know, is begging him to give them the next movie for their archive, for their next project, et cetera. I mean, he doesn't do a lot of TV, but the TV he's done have turned into multi-billion-dollar franchises.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's honestly people are like, oh, your show didn't get on air. And I'm like, you know what? It was good. Could have gotten on air. Factor out of my control. Like, I didn't know Harvey Weinstein was like this level of insanity. Like, mm-hmm. the most I knew about him was like he dated a bunch of attractive stars. But I, not being in the industry, I wasn't even privy to the rumors.
Right, right.
And then when it came out, I was like, oh my God, thank God I'm not on a TV show listed as executive producers, Harvey Weinstein, Jason Calacanis, Carmela Gasolini. Like, this would have been horrible like for
it's
my
career.
It's
good that it just went on ice.
Versus, so much better.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's basically the situation is nobody would ever touch anything with Harvey's name in it. So therefore, it's beyond on ice.
Right,
It's dead forever.
Like, that particular show is dead forever?
Dead forever.
Okay, right. It would have to be a completely new concept.
Yeah, I could never do that show with that IP or with that name or any of that.
Right. But variation.
Well, I mean, listen, I could do any other show, but just not that exact one.
Got it.
I would have to start over kind of thing, yeah.
So we've already alluded to the fact earlier that you are.
I'm going to be your first two-parter, by the way.
I think so. Is great. I think that may be true. I was actually anticipating that before we even spoke.
I like to talk. It's my superpower.
I know. I've heard it's your superpower, and I'm seeing it now before my very eyes. You are often seen as a polarizing figure, which we've already touched on just a little bit. In your book that you wrote, you describe yourself as an investor. You describe your style as judgmental and combative.
Yeah.
And then I heard you in an interview that you did with Arlen Hamilton say that it's really shtick. And so my question
is— Her act or mine?
What's your act?
Oh, okay.
You said to her—
I'm joking. A little bit of shtick to it.
Yeah. And so I guess I just want to know, like, what for all the people that are sort of like, oh, Jason, he's so this, that, the other, what's real and what's not real?
Well, I kind of have enough self-awareness to know I was a bit of an insane editor of a magazine and, you know, iconoclastic— loudmouth early in my career, and I see the power in being candid, right? And so I always try to be super candid with people.
You get compared to Trump.
That's ridiculous. I think I've been compared to Trump
when you walked in here.
I've been compared to Trump by exactly one person, which
that's
is Kara Swisher.
It's been more than one. I have heard you be, and in fact, I mean,
I've only heard her say it. Who else has called me Trump?
I think that
aside
there
from all the team members on the
parallels.
Inside secret chat room that I'm not in,
there are clear parallels.
Okay, go ahead. Reality TV show almost made it to air.
Okay, so that wasn't even on my list.
Not a billionaire.
It starts from trying. That's funny. It starts from trying to get over the bridge to Manhattan. It starts at
that
point.
A little bit of that. Except
I had
no money.
And wanting to be somebody and wanting to make it there and all
except
of that.
He was given $500,000 and I was given a kick in the ass.
True. Obviously, it's not the same.
Yeah.
But then your persona, I think sometimes
bombastic.
You could say, bombastic and
loudmouth.
Combative.
Sure. I would like to think that I'm more intellectually honest and well-researched.
Yes.
And I think he is a compulsive liar and narcissist.
Yes.
I think I am a minor narcissist. He's a major narcissist. Like, part of my shtick is—
I don't see you as a liar, by the way.
No, I mean—
I don't.
There's— I really—
But the narcissist part—
Well, here's the thing. Part of my brand is to be aspirational because I work with entrepreneurs who, in order for us all to succeed, need to be aspirational as well. And I want the most aspirational, aggressive winners to come to me. And here's the trick. When you're an investor, if you have to go find the investments, you're going to spend 9 out of 10 hours finding the investment. If you're me with a podcast and you're the greatest angel investor in the history of Silicon Valley, self-proclaimed, but people repeat it now without citing any source or data.
That's sort of Trumpian.
Which is very Trumpian.
Because you're probably top 10?
Well, I'm probably top 5 right now.
Okay.
And I'm the number one active.
Okay.
So if you just think about it that way, I can make the claim that I'm the number one
with
active.
Qualifications.
With qualifications. but I'll be number one, clearly. Uh-huh. Like, the other ones aren't even investing anymore.
That's maybe a good place to end. But I do have one question I wanted to still ask, which is when you are on your deathbed.
Here we go.
And you look back at your life, what will have given you the most joy?
Yeah. Well, obviously, you know, raising a family and raising productive children in the world who become great adults, who are happy, self-actualized, do great work in the world, and, you know, a loving family unit, I think would be the thing I'd be the top priority. After that, I think if I helped a large number of founders understand their journey and help them succeed, that's like a super mitzvah in the world. Like, because I truly believe that entrepreneurs and capitalism and that system, which is horrible and broken, but they've yet to come up with a better one, is something that is worth fighting for. And fighting against socialism and communism and mediocrity and people not pursuing their dreams and not trying to solve problems is something I feel passionate about and is important in the world.
But that's slightly different than what gives you joy.
Oh, no, it gives me joy.
Is fighting that the fight, same thing?
Yes. That gives me tremendous joy.
To help founders and entrepreneurs. It's not just all about you having an ego and wanting to connect those people because you are...
Honestly, that's not... That doesn't,
Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Well, see, here's the thing. I think when you first get the lightsaber, you want to use it, and it's like super exciting, you know, and you want to be in those battles. And then you get older and you're like, well, I want to resolve these conflicts and just, you know, train people, but I'd be happy enough if they didn't have to use the lightsaber, right? And so... I think that's what the evolution becomes in your life, is that you start looking at what did you do and why did you do it? And then you have the optionality of, well, I get to pick what I do for the last act or the last two acts. And, you know, maybe 10 years ago, I became successful enough to retire and say I could pick what I want to do. And the really explicit choice I made was I love founders. I love these people. I love entrepreneurs. I love, I mean, as crazy as the system is, as many side issues as it creates with polarization of wealth and winner take all and all this other stuff, I get it. There's issues. It's not perfect. But boy, do they solve a lot of problems and make humanity better. And the state of humanity's never been better. And I know that's hard for a lot of people who are still on the bottom to feel, because it feels wrong to say that. But it is the objective truth that the world is getting better for humanity. The people who are in the worst position in humanity are in a much better position than the people who were in the best position a couple of hundred years ago.
What I would like to know, Dan, just in closing, what podcasts are you listening to? What podcasts inspire you? And how can people find you and your shows?
Very simple. You just do a search for This Week in Startups in your podcast player. I'm opening up my... Overcast, which is my podcast player.
Mine too.
Spotify and Overcast are the two best. Right now, Against the Rules with Michael Lewis, quite good. If you're on the right, you should listen to Ben Shapiro. If you're on the left, you should listen to Rachel Maddow's podcast because you need to balance it out.
You mean the opposite.
Watch, no. The left. If you're on the left, listen to the right. If you're on the right, listen to the left.
You said the opposite.
Okay, I said the opposite.
Yeah.
So Rachel Maddow fans, listen to Shapiro. I know it's hard. Shapiro fans, listen to Rachel Maddow. I know it's hard. Cafe Insider, amazing. By the way, I really loved Missing Richard Simmons, and I'm obsessed with Richard Simmons for some reason. Why is that podcast not going to continue? That's like one of my favorites.
Oh, there's a whole story behind that, which I can fill you in on later. But he's done two more podcasts.
I know.
The latest one was great. It was all about the TV show Cops.
I got to watch that.
The Y2K
one was too boring for me. Kevin Rose Show, great. If you don't know Kevin Rose, The Moment with Brian Koppelman, great. Naval, my friend from AngelList, does like a micro podcast that's very good for founders. Sam Harris, Recode Media with Peter Kafka, because I'm in the media business, Reliable Sources of Brian Stelter. He's got a good podcast as well.
He's got a great newsletter too.
Yeah. Stay tuned with Preet and Cafe Insider, Tim Ferriss Show, Under the Skin with Russell Brand and the Woj Pod, amongst my favorites.
Okay. And you're on Twitter?
Jason.
At Instagram, Jason.
Jason. Tumblr, Jason.
All right.
Yes. Don't have jason.com.
Can't get easier than that. Thank you so much for being
my
on the
pleasure.
Show.
Thank you for a wonderful discussion.
I didn't get fired. Hey guys, thanks for listening to my interview with Jason. I had a blast talking to him, and I think he kind of enjoyed it too. Don't forget to tune in on Friday when I release a mini episode about the making of this interview. So now, for the exciting news about season two. Well, the first bit of news is that we're doing a season two, and that's thanks to all of you for listening. Please continue to tell your friends about this podcast or post about it on social media. Let people know that they can now binge every episode and tag me. I'd love to hear what you have to say. Also, while we're on our break, we're planning to share bits and pieces of fun content that didn't make it into the official season, so please don't unsubscribe during this time. I don't know when season two will drop, but I'll keep you posted on my newsletter and on Twitter. What I can tell you is that I've booked a few guests for next season, and today I will share the name of one of them. She is, without question, one of the most badass ladies in media today, Kara Swisher. What has always drawn me to Kara's work is that although she's often thought of as a tech journalist, in truth, her writing reflects so much about our culture at large. She is a current New York Times contributor, and she's also the co-founder of Recode, which brings you the podcasts Recode Decode, Pivot, Recode Media, and the upcoming Reset. I cannot tell you how fired up I am to sit down with her and talk about podcasting. Bring it on. Inside Podcasting is produced and hosted by me, Skye Pillsbury, with massive production help from Michael Sorg at Sidekick Media Services. Charles Quilly is our sound engineer. Rachel Loden is our researcher. And I can now tell you, fun fact, that Rachel is also my mom. Kim Lyons, whose advice and support has been invaluable in the making of this show, is the managing editor at Inside.com. Special thanks to Inside owner Jason Calacanis for greenlighting this project and for sitting for today's interview. And as always, thanks to my family for putting up with my podcast antics. Finally, thanks to all of you for listening, and I hope to see you again in season 2.